everybody. This is David Bixen's fan here with another edition of the Loser Leaves Town podcast here on CageSideSeats.com and LoserLeavesTown.net. I am joined by a legend in Memphis wrestling especially, and for people who know me know that this is not me blowing smoke, one of my personal favorite wrestlers, Superstar Bill Dundee. How are you doing today?
Very good, brother. How about you?
Good, good. I wanted to ask you first, since it's your... one of your current priorities, what exactly is your job at Cole Brothers Circus right now?
I'm the marketing director, one of the marketing directors. About six of us out there keep the show on the road. It goes 7 days a week, 24/7, you know, from March till the end of November. So we're out here 9 months, so show plays every night. It's a hard way to make a living if you work for a circus. Not so much us, but the performers. They go every night.
Do you find
show,
that...
usually.
Do you find that your experience in wrestling and your experience as a circus performer when you were younger help you in this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, the circus and the wrestling is about the same as far as the marketing director part. The only difference is you say the word wrestling instead of circus, so you're promoted the same way. You get it on, you know, ads on TV, in the paper, on the radio, take the clown by, you do all kinds of things. Same thing. The only difference is you know who the real clown is because they got a red nose, and the wrestling sometimes you don't quite know who he was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I got you. Today it's even worse, so they all need red noses today, and most of them,
now,
in my opinion.
Now, when you were a circus performer before you got into wrestling, what did you do? Now, I know you worked high up. Were you a high wire act or a trapeze artist? What exactly did you do?
So I had 11 and that and the trapeze, and I actually looked after the elephants. That's Dale Fisher, an English guy, and I, that was our actual job as far as what we did every day. And then I got this great idea that I would like to be on the trapeze, and I tried that, and that was actually a slack wire. It wasn't really so much the tightrope, you know, the slack wire is slack. So anyway, then I got bit by the wrestling bug, and the rest is history. So I think if I'd stayed with the circus, I would have ended up being a performer, and then... But I like wrestling, the one-on-one thing, so...
Now, so you wrestled for Jim Barnett in Australia for several years before you came to Memphis.
12.
Okay, 12 years. Now, were you still there when the Tennessee talent came in and the Welches started running it, or were you gone by then in Australia?
No, Australia, when Buddy Fuller came there. I was there.
Okay. Did that lead to you going to Memphis, or was it a separate? Did you end up going to Memphis based on them liking your work there?
No, Bobby Shane was the guy who got booked. He was friends with Jerry Jarrett when Mark Loon was the booker for years over there when Jim Barnett run it. Then Barnett sold it out to a guy named Lonnie Coloni or whatever, something like that, Italian dude. And he brought Bobby Shane in as the booker, and he saw George Barnes and I, and he said, you get over Lake Hill in Memphis. You need to go to Memphis, Tennessee. I said, well, we've had a lot of guys tell us all that, but nothing ever happened. He said, well, I can make it happen. So he called Jerry Jarrett that day, and it took about a year to get the paperwork all done. So the beginning of 74 to the end of 74 took to get the paperwork, and then we got here about the beginning of 75, so that's how we got here. Bobby Shane was the guy that got us booked here, and Jerry Jarrett was the guy that booked us for Ghoulish Welsh.
Now, did Johnny Gray go over with you and Barnes at the same time, or did he come early?
No, Gray was a year before us.
Okay. So you ended up teaming together, and now, is it true, by the way, that Johnny Gray is Tony Gurria's brother?
Tony Gurria?
Yeah.
No, he's from New Zealand. No, Gray's, no, Johnny Gray's a different guy. No, they weren't brothers.
No, they're not. Okay, yeah, I heard that, but I thought it didn't sound right for the same reason you said. But anyway, how did they end up going back to Australia, but you stayed?
I really don't know. I mean, I liked it from kind of day one. John Gray never cared much for being here, and Barnes hated it, so... He said, I don't like this place. So, I mean, and then they had different things, you know, over there. I mean, George's family was different, and his wife didn't want to come, and he had a trucking business. He had all kinds of things going, so they had more ties there. I just said, I went from Scotland to Australia, so no big deal. I said, I get to the States, I'm staying. So I had that in mind when I came here.
Okay. Now, how did George Barnes end up coming back about a decade later to feud with you for a few months?
He'd come back to see me, basically, and they asked him if he wanted to wrestle, and that's kind of just what we did, but, you know. So I was teamed up with Rocky Johnson, and George came in, and, you know, he said I was more American than Australian then, so that's kind of how we had the falling out. We did the little month or two thing, and he went home again.
Now, did it take time to adjust to the Memphis style at all, or was it pretty? Were you pretty acclimated to it already when you got there?
No, we was great when we got here. No, bad. Like I said, it was Jim Barnett run it. It was just Georgia Championship Wrestling. He called it Championship Wrestling when he got here. But Mark Lou and King Curtis R.K. and all them guys, Scott Murphy, Bruce Bernard, Tex McKenzie, they all worked the same style here. Tex had been in here. Mario Milana came over there, got over like son of a gun in Australia. And he'd come from Tennessee. So the style was basically the same. We knew what to do when we got here.
Okay. Now, one thing that people always talk about with Memphis, you know, with all the great brawls and stuff, is how, you know, guys like you, Lawler, everyone else, threw the best-looking punches in wrestling. Now, I know some wrestlers, like Terry Funk, would just full-on nail a guy. But, you know, some guys like...
Well, that's not quite true. That's all fucking bullshit. I don't know who tells you all that. That's absolute horseshit.
Okay.
I don't know if you can cuss it on this thing.
Oh, that's fine.
That was how good a worker he was. I mean, that gets heat with me when people say, he just, that's not right at all. I worked with Terry and with everybody else in this business from 1960 to now. So there's more guy gets hurt now than they did back in our day.
That's the truth. And...
Because so, they can't do what we did. And that's just how it is. They can't do what we did. And again, everything has changed. Movies has changed. I don't think John Wayne could get a job making movies today just because the way he made them. It's the same thing the way we worked in the wrestling business or the way we wrestled. First thing the promoter used to say, you went, hey, kid, can you wrestle? You had to be able to wrestle. You don't have to be able to wrestle today. Just big and whatever.
Now, even though, you know, generally, all the, you know, the punches and everything that everyone threw back then looked better anyway. What was it? Was there just a certain way that in Memphis that they sort of tried to teach guys to throw it?
No, everybody could work before they got to Memphis. I mean, me and Barnes had been around 12 years together before we got to Memphis. So I, as far as apart from learning how to be the booker from Jerry Jarrett, I never learned nothing really in the Memphis thing. I mean, we came in and was the star, so people was watching us more, you know what I'm saying? So I didn't really know. If you could work, you could work, and if you couldn't, you couldn't. That's just how it was.
Okay. Not a bad way
to put
it.
Nothing to do with the Memphis part. It's just, you know, they had a lot of good talent back in them days. That's just what it was. There was talent all over the place. Everybody could do, you know, what they could do. But it had nothing really to do with the Memphis part, because half the guys, only Lawler was really from Memphis.
Now, since you talked about learning about booking from Jerry Jarrett, that was something I really wanted to ask you a lot about, was your different booking experience and, you know, your different booking jobs and your philosophies and stuff. So what was your first booking job in wrestling?
Jerry Jarrett.
And what year would that have been?
Oh, hell, I don't know. I got drunk one night and went and talked to him. I said, you need to help me. I need to be the booker. Bill, you ain't going to. I said, well, you're probably right, but you can teach me. So that was about maybe 70, we would get here, 75, 76, 77.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so right around when Jarrett split from Nick Ulis. Around then?
When Jarrett ended up owning his own territory.
Right, so not long after that, okay.
Yeah, he took over in about 76, I guess, at the end of 70, yes, end of 75, or whatever, they ended up falling out and doing all those, you know.
Did you have any reservations about going to Jarrett, or did you know from the second that you heard about it that you're going to go to his promotion, staying with Gulas?
Well, he was just the booker when we got booked. It was Gulas Welsh when Bobby Shane got us booked over here. And, you know, he said, you guys will get over, and I promise you, you will. He said, you work the style like in Memphis. So we took Bobby. He was a friend of mine. That's the one that got killed in the plane wreck in Florida in 75. When Mike McCord and or Austin Idol and Gary Hart and them were on the plane, that he was the only one that got killed. But so he came back to take the book in Florida, and we was going to do our little thing in Memphis, then maybe end up in Florida. But he got killed in that plane wreck. So, but he was a hell of a talent too. So he was a good, you know, he was very good at, you know, officer, whatever else he did. He was the king of wrestling when he came to Memphis. So I mean, came to Australia. He was the first one I ever saw do the King thing. Then we came here, and Fargo had done it, and Lawler had done it, and Ernie Ladd had done it. So, but anyway, that's how I did.
So, as far as booking, were there any specific like philosophies that you had that you would say were unique to you, or just anything, any specific?
No, there was. You know how they make Colonel Sanders chicken? There's a recipe to it. There used to be a recipe to this business, and you had to be around it a long time, and you learned. And the main thing was you made it believable. That's what they don't do today. So, you know, Jerry Jarrett was very good at the angles and knowing what guy to put where and what not to do. You just learned to, you know, every angle that they did or every guy kind of that they put together in Memphis worked because they picked the right guy for the right part. Mm-hmm. And that's just, Jerry Jarrett was very good at that. So you kind of had to learn that. You couldn't make Cactus Jack wrestle because he didn't know how back when he started. I guess he still don't, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. He made a lot of money, but the gimmick fitted him. All the things that he did fitted his character.
Okay. Now, one thing I noticed with your booking that, especially when you went to Mid-South, that you were one of the few bookers who really stressed pushing younger guys. Like, I would say you, maybe Jerry Jarrett and Gary Hart, really stressed pushing, you know, younger wrestlers that the young girls would relate to and that whole thing, you know, and then their boyfriends would come. And I was wondering, was that something you picked up from Jerry Jarrett?
Well, I guess it kind of is. You just had to look around. I mean, I'm not saying this to be braggadocious, but I was a good-looking guy, and I just watched how the girls screamed and hollered, and I thought, well, if there was 10 of me, and Jerry Jarrett was a good-looking guy when he was young, too, so you think if there's me and 10 others look just like me, there's got to be 10 more people, times more people come to the matches. So it wasn't hard to figure if you was cute, the girls would come see you.
Did it surprise you, though?
You're on TV, say that again.
Did it surprise you, though, that not a lot of promotions did that as much as Memphis and Texas and also your run in Mid-South?
Jerry Jarrett was 5'7" or 5'8". I'm 5'7". Bill Watts was 6'2". Ernie Ladd was 6'6". So they all booked guys that they could wrestle. So, I mean, I didn't want to wrestle no monster, so you booked guys your size. And nobody understood that. And it wasn't that we was that smart when we went to Louisiana. They had never seen it. They had never seen the Rock and Roll Express. They had never seen the Midnight Express. So Bill Watts had that territory filled up with Dick Murdoch, Dusty Rhodes, himself, Ernie Ladd, Brody. Every monster in the wrestling business had been to Louisiana. Had made no cute guys. And there was no girls going. When I first went to Houston, Texas, I said, Bill, there's no young girls coming here. He said, well, that's what you're here for. I said, okay. So here comes the Rock and Roll in the Midnight. The first time I went to 1983, went to the first show in Little Rock, Arkansas, it was $9,800 and something dollars. 4 weeks later, it was $45,000 because the Rock and Roll got over in 4 weeks and stayed that way for the next 2 years.
Yeah, that's actually very well documented in that Midnight Express book that Jim Cornette had put out a few months ago. He has all the gates from that period, and you can see, like, I think it was, like, between the first show that the Midnight Express were on in New Orleans and their first show, and then their first show, the next show, which was their first main event in New Orleans, the gate went up something like 70%.
Well, they were wrestling the Rock and Roll Express. Jimmy will put it all over like it was the Midnight Express, but the Rock and Roll was over. You can make a heel, you got to get a baby face over. So,
well, it was the whole package.
And nobody understood the whole thing back then. Nobody knew I was the booker. Nobody. It's all the smart marks. See, I wouldn't have done this show 5 years ago, never mind 10 years ago. And that's what's wrong with this business today. But everybody's smart, or everybody wants to know about it. That's why it's dead. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, so. You know, if you're a small guy and you're the booker, you'll bring small guys around you. If you're 6'6", you'll bring 6'6" guys around you, and that's just how it is. But girls don't like 6'6" guys. If you watch rock and roll singers, if you watch NASCAR drivers, if you watch a lot of things, there's all little guys, and the girls go to see, you know, they don't like the freaking monsters. And that's not that I'm saying big guys, but, you know, they just don't.
Now, in Mid-South, did you have a pretty free hand as booker, or did, I mean...
I was the man.
Okay. Because, you know, I've heard stories about, you know, that Watts, you know, different promoters, I don't know if Watts was one of them, would try to, you know, would get a lot of their ideas in, but Bill Watts would let you have, would pretty much let you have full control.
Wouldn't you? He was selling out. He was dead when I went there.
Okay, now go.
But we never did nothing silly. Now, he wouldn't let you do just stupid things. I mean, you know.
Now, going back a little bit, when you booked the Chattanooga and smaller Georgia towns for Georgia Championship Wrestling in 83, that was about a month or two, do you think that it could have gone better, or do you think just the nature of the setup, bringing in all these new guys in the existing Georgia town, would have failed?
It was starting to go.
It started to go.
I don't know why. It was starting to come up. You know, Ole pulled the plug. Don't know why he did it. Maybe, but the concept was horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, when I had the Fantastics, Terry Taylor and Bobby Fulton, Ole wanted to take them down to the Amity and slaughter them with the Road Warriors, and I wouldn't let him do it. And they never did it. He said, well, what do you mean they ain't doing it? And I said, that's exactly what they're not doing. We're trying to draw in all the little towns, and you'll even go to Ohio and do all the bullshit you do up there with Tommy and what's his name? Him and Tommy had to run in the lane.
But Sawyer?
Yeah. Buzz and Tommy was on fire up in the...
the northern town.
Damn cop, I don't know what the hell he wanted to run in with these lights on, with traffic bumped over, I guess. There's a wreck down here, by the way. So, and it wasn't nothing against the Road Warriors. It was just that we couldn't do what he was trying to do. If they had done that, they would have been the end of them. So, anyway.
Right, it would have killed your top guys. It's the same reason.
No, my baby face. So that was just exactly what it was, and it never happened. But nothing. Then Bobby and them were to say they didn't do it. I said they couldn't do it. I mean, you know, I called down to the army. I wasn't there. You know, you'd be putting, you know, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, they didn't.
Okay. Now, when you were in Kansas City for Jim Crockett, were you booking then? Or were you just wrestling?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was in the office.
Now, what did you think at the time of the idea of running a developmental territory as they sort of framed it, which was really the precursor to what WWE does now in Florida? I mean, did you think it was a pretty good idea?
Well, nobody knew that's what it was. I mean, that's what you can say today, but it wasn't them there. They were out there to help Bob Geigel and them try to get that territory up, and they were doing the best they could with what they had. So it wasn't I've been around forever, so there was me, there was the Barbarian. Dusty would come out and help. I mean, so it wasn't really that, and they never thought of it as that way. And people say all that bullshit today, but they ain't got a clue what they're talking about. So, you know.
It's more of a hindsight thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did the relationship with Crockett and Geigel end up dissolving? I've never really heard any stories as to why this happened.
I never did either. I didn't care. I got paid from Jim Crockett, and I was on a guarantee to be out there, so I didn't really care what it was about. They sent me out there. We'd go out in that damn Learjet and come back every night, you know, fly that all over the place, and then sometimes we'd go on a commercial. But I never lived there. I flew back and forth, so I don't know. I have no clue.
Since you're speaking of, you know, flying on the planes with Jim Crockett, I wanted to ask you something that I thought was interesting in a Gary Hart's book that came out recently, that he loved the Crocketts, and he thought that it was commendable that even though they went out of business, that the money they spent was all on treating the wrestlers well, making sure that they could get home to see their families and stuff. Would you agree with that?
Nope.
No.
Dusty Rhodes wanted them two airplanes. He was the booker, and he talked Jimmy Crockett into buying them. That was so Dusty could get home. So that's the true story there. That's a whole bunch of shit. The Crocketts didn't care about the boys no more than any of the rest of them much.
Okay.
Now, the old man Crockett, they said, I can't talk for the old man. I never worked for him. They said he was pretty well, you know, not too bad. But he was a wrestling promoter, too, and they were all alike, so... I don't know the old man Crockett, so I can't say nothing about that, but, you know, the rest, no. That's bullshit.
Now,
but here's the other thing. If you breed cows and you sell cows and they're making you money, you're not going to mistreat them, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with the rest of us. They would try, you know, but that's horse calls. But anyway,
okay.
That's my opinion, and poor Gary ain't here to defend it now, so, but I just, you know.
Now, you booked for... Ron Fuller in Knoxville, and then shortly after, when Alabama and Knoxville went back together, you booked there. Now, what did you think? Why do you think that the splitting the territories failed? Did you think they just didn't have enough guys? Do you think the fans just weren't into having half of what they had? Do you think that it was that the fans didn't like having half the wrestlers they had before, or what was it?
No, Ron Fuller got tired of fucking with the wrestling business. He just said, I ain't doing this no more.
And that was it, and he sold it.
And then he sold it to a bunch of people that didn't know nothing about what they were doing. So, I mean, if Fuller had stayed, it would have stayed. But that kid had bought it, the Woods kid, the guy that owned the television, he didn't have a clue.
That was actually going to be my next question, actually, that someone suggested I asked you, was David Woods clueless as a promoter? But you already answered that for me.
Well, anybody that's not in this wrestling business is clueless as a promoter. You have to grow up in this thing. That's why it's dead today. The Vince Russos and all the people that are doing the shit today, they ain't got a clue, man. They've never been in the ring. How the hell can you book if you've never, you know, you don't know nothing about it, but it ain't got nothing to do with wrestling. It ain't a show for television, but we do, you know, with believability. You can't defend it today. Okay. And somebody says to you, wrestling's this, and you just go agree with them and say, yeah, because Vince and all them come out and expose it and give it, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, so how can you defend it? Like I said, they used to ask you, hey, kid, can you wrestle? And that's how you used to get in. If you couldn't wrestle, you know, they never gave you a chance. Now, they're, you know, people, they may have let 20 guys a year in the wrestling business back in the day. Now, you know, they have wrestling schools and all the other things, and people will charge other people $500 to teach them to wrestle, and they can't work. So how the hell are they going to teach you?
Going back a little bit, Robert Fuller had a couple runs booking Memphis, and the first of which he brought in pretty much his whole crew, which I guess was a little bit different for Memphis, that he brought in all the guys from East Tennessee. And I was wondering, I mean, what did you think of working for him as a book, you know, with him as the booker? And I'm not sure how to frame this.
I got along good with Robert.
Well,
he did the rest of the thing. I like Robert. Me and him drove up and down the road. He was the booker, and we were tag team champions and all the other things. So I can't say nothing. You know, him and his dad and him fell out or whatever. I don't really know what happened there, but anyway.
Okay, so I wanted to ask, now the feud with Lawler. Did you have chemistry right off the bat? Or did it take some time to fill each other out as far as...
No, he didn't like me and I didn't like him. It showed in the ring. Wasn't hard. But, then we grew to like one another, respect one another, and become buddies. But the beginning, no, I didn't like Lawler. He didn't care for me. We both wanted to be the big fish in the pond, and it worked. Jarrett saw it working, so he just said, you guys do what you do in real life in the ring, you'll make money. And we did.
I believe the first Loser Leaves Town match that you had with each other was the biggest gate in the history of the Mid-South Coliseum, right?
I guess. I don't know. we had a lot of sellouts. You never... I don't know.
Okay.
But I was going to watch then, so then there was, you know...
Now, how did you end up working in WCW?
I really don't know. Bill Watts got a job there, and he called me. He said, you want to come to WCW? And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, work in the office. I said, well, I'd give it a shot, I guess. So 3 months later, he got himself fired, kept all the money that they promised him, and he went home.
Now, you were on the booking committee for a little while, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now, did you think that the committee idea was good, or do you think it was better to just have a single booker?
I never thought they ever worked my way, but nobody cared by that time. Bischoff was the boss, and Mike Graham was on it, Grania was on it, me, Dusty, Flair would put in. How the hell can you do all that? You can't have all that. You know, I would rather just book it by myself, but anyway, I never liked booking committees, but all them guys that was on it knew that, but I don't know what was wrong with it. I didn't like it, so.
Too many cooks spoil the broth, that's the whole thing.
There you go, you got it.
Now,
but the one spoiling it over there was Eric Bischoff, because he ain't got a fucking clue either.
Okay. Now,
absolutely useless.
Now, actually, since you were there at the time, I want to ask, do you know if it's true that he submit? I heard this, and I'm not sure if it's true. Did he submit a resume where he claimed that he was responsible for the success of the AWA?
No, that wasn't how he got the job.
Okay.
He got the job because Bill Watts wanted a guy with a suit to go across from the South Tower to the North Tower. If you've ever been to Atlanta, you'll see them two big old terminal deals down there. And he put Eric Bischoff in that part because he wore a suit every day. And then when he got in there, he bullshitted Bill Shaw and told everybody he could do this and do that and couldn't do nothing. But anyway, Bill Shaw liked him because he was like Bischoff. He'd cut your nuts out for $2. But anyway, that's how it was, two pricks. So anyway, they got together, and that's how Bischoff got his job. It had nothing to do with talent, and nothing to do with nothing.
Okay. Now, I also wanted to ask you about scaffold matches, because you in Memphis were something of the master of the scaffold match, because you all, you know, watching the matches, it showed that you were, because of the experience in the circus and all that, you were much more comfortable than most wrestlers who have ever done it. Now, did you end up just happen to be booked in a scaffold match and you just took advantage of it, or did you come up with the idea based on the fact that you knew you could do well with it?
Technology called a cell phone and dropped you somewhere. So anyway, back to my little story. The first match was Don Green against Jerry Jarrett, and Jerry told me about this scaffold match, and his version was they were 100 feet in the air. They were on a 6-foot ladder with a plank. I got the tape. Somebody found the tape of it way back 100 years ago, and I got it. But anyway, so we were talking one day. Me and Coco were thinking the first one. So we did the thing, and I said, well, we're going to do this. We're going to do it right. So we got a real scaffold, the four tiers of the scaffold, and put it up there. And me and Coco was the first one. And then I was the only idiot that would get up there and run around and go goofy. But anyway, then we had one with Lawler and me against Idol and Tommy Rich. And I don't know if Tommy Rich and Austin Idol ever stood up on the scaffold. I don't think they did, but anyway, we're not supposed to be 40 feet in there. That's how that boy got killed. We've been doing silly shit.
Now, the idea that with, at least, I know the match with Coco Ware was, and the idea of it being 2 out of 3 falls, literally. I know that the original Jarrett-Don Green match was like that, but, you know, on the much lower scaffold. So was that his idea to do that, and he just decided to go with it?
What's that?
The 2 out of 3 falls for the scaffold match.
No, we just added it or did well. Who knows? We probably went out there and said something. That TV was live, and it was never – somebody gave you an idea what to say or do, and then you'd get out there and you'd get rolling, and you would say stuff, and you know, add stuff, take it away. I said, well, we'll go 2 out of 3, Coco. See how tough you are, blah, 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 and just whatever. Who knows how it was ever booked that way? Maybe it just ended up that way.
Okay,
but it was a whole different era today. I mean, you know, people talk about this or that like they were always smart, but they weren't. It's today's thing, and they watch the old Memphis tapes, and they watch the stuff today, and they had no clue that Bill Dundee was the booker, or Jerry Lawler was the booker, or even Bill Watts when he wrestled and booked his own territory. Nobody knew who the booker was.
Now,
except the boys. They knew, but none of the fans knew.
Now,
and they never wanted to know it. I still never really wanted to know it was me that did it. But, you know, but that's just how it is.
Yeah, that's how it is. When you were booking, was it mainly creative, or did you also handle stuff like the payoffs and stuff?
Oh, no, no. You never got your hand in the till now. They never let you get near the cash register. So you just filled up the buildings, and they dished out the money. So.
Okay. Now, I went as far as Memphis goes. What do you think was it that just made it such an attraction in that city where, you know, probably the highest TV ratings of any wrestling show, you know, on par, you know, in locally, it did as well as pretty much the best network shows. What do you think was it that made it such an attraction in the city with the TV and everything?
Cute little fella, a little cute guy from Australia, looked like Elvis. No, Jerry Jarrett was cute, and never took off till Jerry Jarrett really started booking, and Lawler got over. So the local guy in Memphis, the King of Memphis, Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett's brains, and, you know, that's how it got over. And Fargo was over like a son of a gun, and Sputnik Monroe was over in the good old days, but they were down a little, they weren't in the Coliseum back in the day, but the TV show got a hell of a rating. And here's the other thing. You know, back in the day, there were three channels. Mm-hmm. So if you have cartoons on one, an old black and white movie on the other, then you go an hour and a half of a wrestling show where guys could do it and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the girls tuned in to see Bill Dundee and Jerry Lawler and all them other cute little devils like the rock and roll. So you had a good chemistry. So it was a 64 share and a 17 rating. That is unheard of today. Two rating. If they get a two, they think it's great. TNA gets a one and a dot and they think it's great. They ain't got a clue.
They get the same rating every week and they think it's great if it goes up a tenth of a point.
That's what I'm saying. So, I mean, if Jeff Jarrett had half the brains of his dad, he would still have his dad there, but I'm not getting into that. That's another story, but we're not talking about him. We're talking about me, so.
So, speaking of talking about you, did you prefer to be, I guess, also, is a good guy or a bad guy?
Whatever drew money. You know, I never considered nothing. I just went out and made interviews. So if they wanted to boo me, fine. If they didn't, that would be fine, too. Lawler was the same way. I mean, it was, you know, when we come here, it was the bad guy because we were foreigners. But after they liked me, it was hard for them to get them to boo me. But anyway.
So all business. One wasn't more fun than the other. Just mattered whichever drew better.
Well, right. And that's why I never did it for fun. I did it for money. I never got in this business because I liked it or it was this or that. But I mean, I could make money at, and I had a talent for it in the ring and out of the ring and, you know, the office. And that was what it was about, money.
All righty then. Now, I want to just go through some different guys who you've, you know, crossed paths with in your career, just ask you about them and get your thoughts. The Freebirds, you wrestled really just when they were starting. Did you think, you know, when you're wrestling these these two teenagers on Memphis TV, did you think that they'd become big stars and, you know, draw the big Superdome crowd or anything like that? Or could you see that they had the potential?
They had talent. Michael Hayes had a lot of charisma. He wasn't the best wrestler in the world. And Gordy was a big guy. He was 16 or 17 years old when he came to Memphis. He was a big old boy. And yeah, they had charisma. Then they put Buddy Roberts with him. And the reason they put Buddy, because Watts didn't think that Gordy could work, Hayes could work. So he put the other two to work and him be the manager. That's how they become three. Bill Watts was working against him and he didn't like working against Hayes.
Now, also, what about Dream Machine Troy Graham? What did you think of him as far as, do you think he could have been a bigger star in other territories?
Yes, he could have been a big star. Dusty wanted to go to Charlotte with him. He wouldn't go. He wouldn't go nowhere. He liked Memphis. That was just how he was. He's a good guy, and that was just what he wanted to do.
Just one of those guys.
He could talk. He could talk better than anybody in this business. Could you imagine him and Dusty Rhodes making interviews back in the day?
Oh, yeah. That would be great.
Well, Dusty Rhodes was the same way. He saw him, and he wanted him to come over to Charlotte, and he wouldn't do it.
Same way, it's like Austin Idol, like he didn't really like to travel that much.
I don't know what Austin, well, hell, he was in two car wrecks and I know of in a plane wreck. Why would you?
Well, that's true. But anyway, what about Jimmy Valiant? What did you think of him?
I love handsome Jimmy. He's, as a matter of fact, I just talked to his ex-wife, Felicia. She lives in this town right here in Vero Beach. So, Big Mama, if you hear this, how are you? So, I loved handsome. He was married to Felicia back then when I knew him. She worked, wrestled, or managed him as Big Mama. But anyway, an old handsome friend of mine, so I liked handsome. A lot of charisma.
I also wanted to ask you about your wrestling school. Is that still going on right now? Or?
Yeah, we still have in Henderson, Tennessee. Yeah, we still got one in Henderson, Tennessee. Kevin White runs it right this minute. It's basically his, but I mean, I'm on the road, so he runs it. But yeah, we go back, still do it. Still there. If you want to learn to wrestle, you can get hold of me or Kevin White and do the thing. The same number you call me on is the same one from the wrestling school, which is 731-431-2010. So any kid wants to be taught the right way how we did it, get hold of that number and call the superstar.
So you started the school about, it's been over 20 years now, I guess, on and off, or the whole, just constantly the whole time?
Well, kind of the whole time, but on and off, basically. But the one I had way back 20 years ago, I was about the first one to do it. Now, but around this area, we was kind of running out of talent, so Jerry Jarrett said, we need a wrestling school or something. So I said, well, I'm just the boy to run it. So we got the thing going, and did it, and Jeff tried to take over when he got in the wrestling business and all, but he couldn't work, so how the hell was he going to teach anybody else? He was a fair middle of the road card, but apart from that, that's it. That's why he never drew no money for his father or TNA.
Who else have you trained besides Kevin White and Todd Morton? I guess your son as well. Who else have you trained? Those are the ones I'm most familiar with that I know you trained.
Well, we had a team named, what the hell was his name? The Garvin and this other kid we put them together. Hell, I don't know.
Oh, Terry Garvin and Mark Galeen?
Yeah, Terry Garvin and Mark Galeen. We had them with a pink mat and all that kind of thing. So we had them and we had, Cat Garrett was one. We had him for a while. A lot of them quit the business because they got disgusted in it, just with the same, you know, and then it was making a change then. So there was a lot of them.
So, a lot of the younger guys that showed up in Memphis back then came through your school.
Yeah, we needed them for Saturday morning too. So you would bring them down Saturday mornings and work with them and do whatever. Yeah, that's kind of why it got started to start with. You know, we had all the stars we needed. We needed journeymen.
Okay. Now, one thing I really noticed, at least with, you know, Todd Morton and Kevin White, that they do have a very similar style to you. And is that, you know, is it just, you know, were there certain things that, you know, did they just pick up on it from learning from you, or was it more that they were a fan of you, or what?
No, you taught them right. I mean, they got taught the psychology, so that's what the part they're seeing on that. I mean, if you don't teach the kids psychology, the monkey can wrestle, the bear can wrestle. The bear wrestles. He puts holds on you, and you do all things with the bear, but the bear can't think. So when you have a guy like he's been in the business all his life, and he's telling you, hey, brother, you do this because of this, or this, or this, don't do that. It looks bad, or this or that. And they pick up on it, and so that your style becomes a kind of the same because you're telling them not to make mistakes.
Does it frustrate you that there are so many schools with all these guys who either don't have the experience or didn't draw money or anything?
No, it doesn't frustrate me because they don't do what I did, and I'm out of the wrestling business. And I'm with a circus where the clowns have real noses, you know, and you know what the clown is. The guys in the wrestling business should be wearing a red nose. It's not, and their runner should be wearing a red nose, and they're not. So, no, it doesn't frustrate me because I don't go around it. And if you want me to wrestle, I give you a price. You pay me, I go. You don't. And if we go, we do it my way, and we don't do it at all. So that's how we do it.
Okay, then. I guess that's about it. One more person I wanted to ask you about, Nick Bockwinkel, because he came through Memphis a lot as the world champion.
He was the world champion. Hell of a guy, class act, hell of a worker. He could wrestle. You can't say nothing but good things about Nick Bockwinkel. He was a class act, brother.
How did the switch to mainly booking the AWA champion instead of the AWA champion end up happening?
Instead of the NWA one?
Yeah, why did Jerry Jarrett decide to do that?
You didn't have to wait as long, because Harley was, when he was doing it, and Flair was doing it, and the Funks and Terry was doing it, they were going all over the place, so you may want him on the night, and you couldn't get him. But you could kind of get Bockwinkel there about 4 weeks ahead or 3 weeks. They call up Gagne and say, hey, man, I need him in 3 weeks. You could get him. You may have to wait 3 months to get the NWA champion.
So it made it
because they worked every night somewhere, huh?
So it really made it easier to run things because
yeah,
you did, right? Okay, then.
We was a weekly show, and we would like to have a weekly champion if we needed him. If he come in for 4 weeks or 5 week program, you could get him. You couldn't get the world's champion like that, except every now and again.
Now, you ended up working a little bit on AWA shows in the Midwest, I guess, when you won the tag titles. Now, I want to ask you, I mean, did it seem like, you know, they were kind of running on fumes or what?
Yeah, it was, Hogan had sold that and went to Vince. They're all wishing they hadn't done it now, but greed and everything else and bullshit from Vince McMahon and all the things. Now it's a monopoly. Now there's no place to go to work. Now they're all older. They can't get booked. If they had just waited and hadn't sold that to Vince and said, well, I'm not going to, he took everybody from everywhere. The last one to go was Lawler from Memphis. That's why we was around a lot longer. And, you know, that's just what they did. They all sold that, and they went to Vince. Now you could do what Vince tells you, or you don't work. And only the chosen few are making money. I'm sure Hogan made enough all the way he did, and he didn't do his movies and all the stuff that he did. Well, good luck to Hulk. But if he'd stayed, would kept the territories, but they all went. Every star that was in a territory left and went to him on them pay-per-views.
Did you ever have a chance to go, or were you just content in Memphis?
I was kind of content in Memphis, and I was always really too small for Vince. Vince really does like big guys, so why go up there and prostitute yourself to death? And, you know, being really too small, you could do it better than most of the big guys, but they wouldn't let you, so why are you going?
Have you ever just kind of, I guess, speculated about what if you had come along a little bit later? Do you think you would have?
No, you can't think. You can't think like that. Yeah, not a clue. It would be like saying that the guy that started NASCAR, you know, would they all wish they were? They were doing the thing at the time they were. Would you want to be born 20 years from now? No. This is what we did. They never had as much fun as we did. Memphis was the best and the highest rated show ever in the history of wrestling, so I had a 20-year run on that. So I've had my 10 minutes in the sun, so I have no regrets on nothing.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I mean, I was good at what I did, and I knew it, and the promoters knew it. So, I mean, I drew money. Everywhere I went, I drew money. Too many people can say that. And I'll tell you another thing there's not two people can't say apart from me and Jerry Lawler. There's not two other guys that went to the same building 52 weeks a year and sold that as many times as me and Lawler did over a 20-year run, the same place, same two guys. You can't tell me that any terror raid had them. They didn't. Now, Rick Steamboat and Flair was over there in Charlotte. They were kind of the Lawler and the Dundee that thing. But that was me pressing the button. So, they never was around 20 years together over there. And we worked tag team against one another, whatever. As long as we was in the same ring, the people bought a ticket to see, and they didn't care if we was wrestling or tagged up or whatever. As long as And we had a chemistry for some reason.
How
it lasted that long. Yeah.
How important would you say Lance Russell was in the success of Memphis?
He was very important. He was very important. I mean, he's a good announcer, but that's what he was, and he knew what he was. He didn't want to be the star. Most announcers try to be the star. Lance was what he was, and Dave was Lance's sidekick. Remember Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon?
Mm-hmm.
Ed laughed at everything Johnny did. Well, that was the same type of thing with Lance and Dave. Dave knew what he was there for, and Lance was the star announcer, and Dave was the ring announcer. Not sure they knew it. But they were very good together. They were very good together.
Okay. Last thing I want to ask you, since you talk about how you don't really like the current wrestling scene much at all, are there any wrestlers in WWE or TNA who you do think are good and could have hacked it out?
I couldn't tell you who they are because I don't watch it. I haven't watched a Vince show in 20 years. I mean, I know the Undertaker's still there. Triple H is still there because I knew him from. And we helped start Shawn Michaels. That's about all I know.
All those guys who eventually were in WWF, the ones who became the big stars, could you see it back then? Or was.
Who was that?
That they would be, you know, guys like Austin and Undertaker and Rock who all came through Memphis.
Well, yeah, they all had charisma. Rock came through as Flex Cavani. You knew he had charisma. But yeah. And, you know, Austin had it. You know, they all had it. We pushed them. They were on top there. So it was just a matter of getting a break.
Was there anyone who surprised you as far as being a big star?
No, because I was the booker and I knew if you had talent once a minute. I can tell you when you walk in the dressing room, you never draw any money or not. Mm-hmm. If I tell you you suck, you suck. Now, not on today's shit because I don't watch it, but I'm telling you back in the days because that guy, he ain't going to draw you a dime. And I wasn't very wrong with none of them. That was one of the things that, you know, when you picked the talent, and Jerry Jarrett was very good at that. You could look at the guy and know what he could do and he couldn't do. Ricky and Robert looked like rock and roll stars, and that was really Lawler's deal. So he said, how about if we tie the bandanas around them and do all this and blah, blah, blah. And Ricky Gibson said, I ain't doing no, I ain't going to the ring looking like that. Well, he made a fortune looking like that. So that's how they were born. And then everybody had a team. We had the Rock and Roll and the Midnight Express called themselves that because of the Rock and Roll Express. Then they had the Midnight Rockers up there for the AWA. That was Jannetty and Michaels. But Shawn Michaels could work from the first day I saw him. Jose Lothario brought him down to Houston Coliseum to try out for Bill Watts when we were the bookers. So I went with Watts to watch him. He was first day, you could tell the kid could work. But so could Jose Lothario, and he taught him, so how can you not?
One last thing I want to ask you before we go. What did you think of Texas when Jerry Jarrett combined them into one promotion?
That was a screwed up deal when we went to Dallas. Mm-hmm. I didn't know much about that at all, but Kevin was the one that pulled the plug on all that. So it was starting to come. I bet he wished he hadn't done it because he went out of business. I have no clue. I wasn't in that part. We'd just go on the Willing Jennings' old bus. We hired that, and we'd go down in that bus to Texas and come back and do Memphis TV. Some mornings we'd drive all night to the driver. We'd sleep. So that would do that. And that would be Friday night and Saturday morning TV we did down there. Sometimes some of us come back from Memphis, so I have no clue. Now, Kevin, I don't know what happened to him. He just come in one day and said, "You're all out of here," and I guess he had the papers to prove it, and we left. And then he died about a month later. Never drew nothing. But I'm sure he had all them old guys that hung around Texas and get them Tennessee guys out of here and we can take it back. Because we were drawing on real houses, man. We was doing good business. Jerry Jarrett had it back popping.
And that's definitely the truth. I mean, the show where Eric Embry beat Phil Hickerson, that was like the first sellout I think they had in a long time. So,
definitely. We had it clicking.
Yeah. So I guess that's about it. Just want to thank you for doing this. Just want to ask if you have any closing thoughts.
It's on. Not really. I mean, like you said, I don't miss the wrestling business. I miss what I did. We did. But as you get older, and you know your body gets beat up, and you don't really want to do it. If we could stay young forever, that would be great. But that's time to retire anyway. I'd have been out of the ring anyway. If I'd still been in Memphis, if it'd still been around, probably promoting or doing whatever. Still helping in with the booking, but as far as getting in the ring and taking bumps, that's done. That's over.
Okay, I want to thank you for your time for doing this, and everybody, if you want to contact Bill Dundee about wrestling school or the Coal Brothers Circus or whatever, you can go to superstardundee.com, and that'll have his email address, and I'll also put up the phone number for the circus and wrestling school office on the website. So everybody go to loserleavestown.net for the archive of shows and cagesideseats.com for your various wrestling and MMA news on the blog there. Thanks, everyone. Take care.